From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Deprogram with Michael Parker on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Greetings, truth seekers, paradigm busters, new world order, civil disobedience, freedom fighters, free thinkers, higher mammals, good people of all types. How's it going? It is Michael Parker coming to you as always from an undisclosed location somewhere in the underbelly of the universe, otherwise known as Los Angeles, California, the myth maker for a civilization. And it is Monday. So we're kicking this thing off. It's going to be a really big show today. And I kid you not, I say that a lot, but it really is a big show today. We're going to be joined in the first hour by Dr. Andrew Huff. He has been all over the media in the last week or so talking about his book. And today we are very pleased to have him on the show. In the second hour, Charlie Robinson from Macroaggressions is going to come back on the show. We had a great talk last week, and we're going to continue up on some of these tabletop exercises because we've just found out that there was another one in October, and we're going to talk about these mysterious deaths of these journalists at the World Cup. And also our friend John Matlin's got a couple of stories for us. Before we get to all of that, you guys, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but apparently there is another baby formula recall in the works. And this has been announced. And luckily, I don't have babies in the house anymore. My daughters are grown up, so I don't have to worry about this. But the Food and Drug Administration has announced that a baby formula maker has now issued a voluntary recall of its formula after it was found by a third party that it had a potential cross-contamination with, guess what? Potentially deadly bacteria. Now, you remember this past year, we had the Abbott run closure of a Michigan plant, which was the largest maker of baby formula in the U.S., and that caused huge problems, and that was a result of supposedly contamination hazards. Well, now we've got another one. This recall involves a product called ByHeart's Whole Nutrition Infant Formula. I'm not familiar with it, but I've been out of the game for a while. And this was initiated after a sample was conducted by a third-party packager, and they found what they call, and this is like many, many syllables, so bear with me, folks, Chronobacter sakazaki. I think I said that correctly. It sounds bad. It sounds exotic. It apparently can cause life-threatening infections like meningitis. That is no good. So the company has done a voluntary recall. And if you have any of this brand, the ByHeart Whole Nutrition Infant Formula, I would basically say, you know, return it or throw it out. I wouldn't even fool with it, but they're saying to look on the bottom and see what the dates are. The particular article that I am referencing doesn't have a production date associated with it, so I can't give that to you. But once again, the product is called ByHeart's Whole Nutrition Infant Formula. And like I say, if it was in my house and I had an infant, I would either return it or I would just throw it out. I wouldn't even fool with trying to see. So we've got another potential recall. Well, it's going to happen. It is a recall of baby formula, and I hope that it won't get to the extent of the one last year, because that really did cause a lot of problems for a lot of people. So just bringing that to you because I saw this right before I came on to the show. You guys, do you have an opinion or a comment? Let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at TNT Radio. We would like to hear from you. We are lighting the fuse for freedom here on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
News reported fairly.
They are a reliable source.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
The Twitter Files Drop 5 is underway today. What will we find out? Here to break it down is TNT News producer John Matlin.
We are in the midst of another Twitter Files drop. This is the fifth one of its kind. Barry Weiss was the one in charge of it today, and happening during a Monday afternoon, which has been different from the late night weekend type of deal. So this starts off with Trump having one remaining strike on his account. Trump tweeted twice saying that 75 million votes he received will have a voice long into the future and that he will not be going to the inauguration on January 20th. Of course, that was of 2021. The stance of Twitter and world leaders is as follows, pertaining to world leaders is as follows. Quote, our mission is to provide a forum that enables people to be informed and to engage their leaders directly, end quote. The goal, to protect the public's right to hear from their leaders and to hold them to account. The voices from both the inside and outside that called for Trump to be removed from Twitter existed for years, but hit a fever pitch after January 6th. One Twitter employee wrote, quote, maybe because I'm from China, I deeply understand how censorship can destroy the public conversation, end quote. What was written back is amazing. Quote, it is important to understand that censorship by a government is very different than censorship of the government, end quote. With this banter began the threats against democracy and labeled and restricted tweets from Donald J. Trump. More employees on Slack called for his ban. One employee on Slack channel chat said, quote, pretty obvious he's going to try to thread the needle of incitement without violating the rules, end quote. The feelings and perception of Twitter employees decided to be the reason that they cut the sitting president off from a means of communication that did not involve the mainstream media cartel. Speaking of the mainstream media cartel, The Washington Post published a letter that CEO Jack Dorsey that was signed by over 300 Twitter employees demanding the ban of the president. The Twitter staff had already decided after reviewing the tweets that Trump did not violate the terms of service set forth by Twitter and even said they would have a hard time saying that he incited the events. Multiple employees on the Slack channel and there agreed there was no incitement, followed by a Twitter policy official named Anika Navaroli saying, quote, I also am not seeing clear or coded incitement in the DJT tweet. I'll respond in the elections channel and say that our team has assessed and found no vios, and vios means violations. The crazy part of this is that official, Anika Navaroli, would later testify to the January 6th committee, quote, and say, quote, for months I had been begging and anticipating and attempting to raise the reality that if nothing, if we made no intervention, that there would be no intervention into what I saw occurring, people were going to die, end quote. Though in her own words, nothing was wrong with his tweets, and there was no angle for getting to that conclusion. Other world leaders tweeting for violence or normalizing it remained posted and untouched. World leaders calling for the eradication of Israel or the right for Muslims to kill millions of French people seem to pass the test of Twitter's terms of service. Yoel Roth, a head official, said, quote, people implementing our policies are like Nazis following orders, end quote. The pressure was building and then it broke and the policy did not hold up. Donald J. Trump was put on permanent suspension with the reasoning behind it, quote, due to the risk of further incitement of violence, end quote. These things are very interesting, Michael. What is your take?
Well, you know, whenever we're talking about incitement of violence, I always go back to all of these people that were threatening violence against Donald Trump during his presidency, which I thought was extremely distasteful. And yes, I voted for the man, but I wouldn't have done those kinds of things against Obama or the Bushes or the Clintons, any of those people, none of which I really liked. It's just that's not the way I play. So all of this coming from Twitter to me has always been disingenuous. Look, they were dying to kick Trump off of Twitter. And, you know, I think they were just kind of going through the motions of acting like they were having a conversation about it when they knew all along that they were going to do it. When J6 came along, that was their open, closed case in their mind that they were able to do it. What I'm curious about is what comes out now, because so far the things that we've heard are the things that we expected. And those of us who are on the right or conservative or libertarian, we saw happening to the people that we follow. We saw it happening to our own tweets and just how we had no growth. So we had to assume that something was going on. So right now I'm waiting to see what comes out in the next batch. And I have not had a chance this morning to go over fully from Barry's drop today that you sent me. But so far it's everything that we thought had happened.
Yeah, and other world leaders as well were having this conversation that this wasn't acceptable. Other people that were running in other countries, this is what they always say is the slippery slope. And they knew that there was nothing that was done to actually go through with the suspension, and they said it on every single level. It just came down to the pressure of the ultra-left employees of Twitter teaming up with that Washington Post article and that mainstream media cartel putting the pressure on, and Twitter did what they were told. So is there any more deeper stuff? I guess maybe not. Maybe there isn't. Maybe it was just simply the entire thing fell apart when they got pressure from the employees. But I mean, this, it was like a union mentality at that point that they were basically saying, you guys are just as bad as Trump. You guys are Nazis if you allow it to continue, because I feel. There's a lot of feeling going on, but there's no evidence.
I feel. Oh my God. Yeah. And well, this, the gnashing of the teeth that's happening right now as a result of Elon's takeover of Twitter, I'm still enjoying it. And it's, they have just turned on him. I mean, everybody used to love Elon Musk, and now they've turned on him. Apparently he got booed yesterday. I don't remember if it was at a football game or, oh no, it was a Dave Chappelle concert, apparently.
Dave Chappelle.
So now they're going to boo Elon. I don't think Elon really cares that much. And my wife even said to me that she thinks he needs to dial it down. I don't know that he does, man. I think that I like the fact that he's laying it all out there. I still don't, I'm not going to say that I implicitly trust the guy because I don't know what's going on with him, but I do like the fact that somebody's showing some spirit here and is turning over the rocks so that we can see all the worms and bugs and hideousness that we knew lay behind all of this digital infrastructure.
I think that Elon Musk would have to go on stage, not in San Francisco, but somewhere else where there's a lot more free-loving Americans that want to know the truth. I was having arguments with people on Twitter throughout the day as I was watching this unfold, and one person in particular was saying horrible things about Elon Musk, yet they had the Ukrainian flag as their profile picture, and they were damning Elon Musk for everything he's done. And I said, without this man, for your sake, I'm just saying, without this man, there would be no satellite dishes floating around giving internet to the military of the Ukraine. The military comms would be down. So you're hating on him, but it seems like the flag that you're virtue signaling for needs him. So there's a lot going on. I'm just trying to wake people up to just their hate. I mean, when it comes down to it, Michael, he needed to come out with this stuff. It needs to be done. This is the best thing that could have happened. I don't trust the guy as far as I could physically throw him, but on this topic, he's getting the stuff out that needs to be out. And in the meantime, I'm calling everyone out for their usual bullcrap. If you're going to hate Elon across the board, hate him across the board, don't sing his praises because he put up some SpaceX satellites. And then when he tells the truth, it hurts your feelings, so you throw a temper tantrum. We need to see these documents, and I think that's what we're going to continue doing, is seeing these documents.
And John, do you know when this software update's going to roll out that supposedly is going to let people like us know if we were shadow banned or not?
I don't know. I can't wait for it. And I really can't wait for it. I can't wait for it because if there was something that's put on, and if you could go back as far as getting the dates, Michael, and say it kicked in right when I started to run, I'm just curious, because that's what I experienced on Instagram, if it was across all social media platforms, and that's what we would call a smoking gun, because I didn't have a big following. I don't have a big following on Instagram. I'm only starting to grow it now because I'm able to reach people. But, you know, if they went out of their way to put a low visibility filter on me, and what I experienced on Instagram, which was mathematically impossible, then you know that this is all working in tandem, and we're starting to really see how this works.
Listen, I'm sure you were probably shadow banned, and I think that, especially within Twitter, but probably across all of them, they have algorithmic data that allows them to just shadow ban people. They don't even have to know what you said. You fit, in my opinion, I think you fit a couple of criteria. You don't have to be a big person. You just need to fit some of these criteria that they found objectionable. Of course, that's, you know, objectionable. And then you get shadow banned. So even though they might not know who Michael Parker or John Matlin is, the software and the algorithm they created, I bet, could automatically shadow ban you.
Yeah, and that all comes down to AI. They transcribe everything in real time.
Yeah.
So that could be taken off on the back end, and I guarantee you. Well, of course, I can't really guarantee you. It's an alleged personal opinion that mostly anybody that shared anything that comes from a conservative website had that filter applied to them automatically once the system knew you did it. But I'm just looking for anything specific that was added right before the election, say in the February 20 to 28 area. That was when Instagram, that switch flipped for me. And yeah, so I mean, that would be directly correlating. So it'd be very interesting. We all know these social media networks work together to some degree about how to keep this narrative in check. And I think the glue that holds them all together is the U.S. government. And that's a very big problem.
It certainly is. John Matlin, thank you for that report. And we will see you again in the second hour. You guys, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we have a huge guest. It is Dr. Andrew Huff. We're going to talk about his book about what really happened in Wuhan. We'll be right back.
Servoy Morich on TNT Radio.
Three people have been killed, and at least two nuclear-capable bombers were likely damaged in separate blasts at two Russian airfields. Two Tu-95 long-range strategic nuclear bombers were damaged by a drone that fell on the runway at the Engels Airfield in western Russia's Saratov region. So drone warfare, Skynet is becoming self-aware. I think more and more we're going to begin to see countries utilizing, testing, you know, kamikaze drones, drone swarms. We have drone Black Hawk helicopters now that don't need humans on board. All sorts of, you know, self-driving tanks and that sort of stuff. So it's only a matter of time, but it's war. That's the name of the game.
Servoy Morich on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going to lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here.
Have one kind of education and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at SalemNow.com.
If you want the jibby jab,
all right, enough.
Then you've come to the wrong station. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All righty, truth seekers, this is the big one you've been waiting for. In this hour, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Andrew Huff. He has the new book that everybody's talking about, The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. Dr. Huff is a combat veteran, a technologist, infectious disease epidemiologist with decades of experience in scientific research, national security, and entrepreneurship. He was a senior scientist and eventually a vice president at EcoHealth Alliance and was a senior member of the technical staff at Sandia National Laboratories beforehand. And in this book that I'm sure you've heard about now, especially if you listen to TNT, he talks about how the... the COVID, SARS-CoV-2 virus, it's everything we thought. I mean, it did come out of Wuhan, and we did help pay for it out of our own tax dollars. Dr. Huff, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
I appreciate you being here, and I've been reading the book. I've been listening to your interviews, and I think, given the amount of time that we have, I think we're going to jump right into it. I'm looking for a particular, on page 135, you had an outstanding thing that, now of course I can't find it. Here it is. This is the statement that
you say page 135. I don't have the pages memorized, so I have to look myself.
It's okay, but what you say, because here's where I want to jump off on. It says, bioweapons don't kill people. People kill people. And people, including myself, frequently make mistakes. The reason I bring that up is because you say quite a few of these interviews and in the book that, you know, you were opposed to gain of function research, you know, even when you were in college, and yet you end up working for this entity that's in fact exactly what they do.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one thing, it's important to note that dissenting opinions and skeptics and contrarians are important to science and logic and critical thought. It's going back to 2005, that's when the split happens in the field of infectious disease research and public health and virology. You know, 50% of the scientists were for gain of function, the other half were against it. And I think over time, my camp, the camp has always been against gain of function research, has been proven to be right based on current events.
I would say so. And the thing about this, especially for people who listen to TNT and my show, none of this really comes as a surprise for us. I mean, I thought from day one that this was a man-made virus, and I'm not Nostradamus or a genius. It's just what I thought. And I remember in one of your interviews or in the book, you said that you heard about it towards the end of 2019, even though that you had worked at Eco Health Alliance. Now you were out of the company and you moved on, but you began to hear about it. And I heard about it through my crazy conspiracy lore in December of 2019. I started reading about this thing and I was producing another show. And when I came back, I told the host of that show, hey, this is the story of 2020. It's going to be this virus. And he looked at me like I was nuts. But the idea that this was a man-made virus and that the United States government helped pay for it, I don't think comes as a surprise to anyone. The surprise is, the big question is, was this really an accident? Because you say that this was an accident based upon their inadequate security measures.
Absolutely. So the way that I come to that conclusion is pretty simple. So first of all, the virus looks like it emerges in late August or September of 2019. That's hard scientific fact, I believe, at this point. It was research done by a number of epidemiologists looking at blood serology and other types of correlated data. These scientists were from all over the world. They independently analyzed different data, came up with the same conclusion. So I think that's rock solid. So the only question then is, you know, how did this come out? Well, if you look at the Chinese Communist Party's behavior, the behavior at the Wuhan Institute of Virology immediately preceding that event, it looks like they're buying containment equipment and they're trying to plug a leak and they're going into cover-up mode. You know, everyone wants to say this looks like an intentional event, but the way that I shoot that down the book and I discuss at the end of the book is pretty simple. If you look at the Chinese Communist Party's stated objectives 2016 to 2019, they want to increase their dominance globally. They want to increase the size of the Chinese Communist Party. There's no better way to fail at those objectives than having a virus escape in your own country. Some people have claimed it was a false flag attack. I don't buy that for a second. That would be instant global World War III. And you would also want to make sure that you had the medical countermeasure on your side if you release it in someone else's country, because eventually it will come back to you. So those things weren't in play yet. So I think this is just a good old-fashioned sloppy lab leak. I firmly believe that.
Okay. All right. Well, I know that let's back up a little bit, because one thing I learned from reading the book and listening to your interviews is that Eco Health Alliance didn't really start out as what it is. It started out as more of an environmental type business entity. And when Daszak took over, he changed that mission. And I'm wondering if that was the plan all along.
I'd ask myself the same question. So you're right. Eco Health Alliance, before it was Eco Health Alliance, was a wildlife conservation organization, traditional. You know, you give them money, they go buy land, they protect animals, sort of like the Nature Conservancy. Well, they weren't making a lot of money at that. So when Peter Daszak took over, he transforms it into, well, we're going to conserve the environment to prevent emerging infectious diseases. That's sort of the pitch. Well, after I'm promoted from senior scientist to vice president, I find out that we're not spending any money on conservation. I actually asked that in a meeting, right, and I was shocked to hear that. And actually, yeah, I was pissed off, because that was one of the reasons why I went to work there. And back to your point, I mean, this does look like a very, very clever way to go sample and collect biological information, genetic samples on viruses globally. The thing that I like to point out to people is that everyone blames Dr. Anthony Fauci for funding this gain of function research, but actually, and I have the documents to prove it, I released them on Twitter. My handle is AGHUFF, AG Huff on Twitter. You can go download all my documents. in the understanding the risk of bat coronavirus emergence proposal, they state that they began this research under the USAID PREDICT program. That program is what transforms Equal Health Alliance and makes it profitable before Dr. Anthony Fauci even knows who these people are, or at least is actively involved in managing or funding the work there.
I am speaking with Dr. Andrew Huff. We've got to take our bottom of the hour quick news break. You guys stick around. There is a lot more that we're going to talk about this, and it's blowing my mind. This is TNT Deprogrammed. We'll be right back.
TNT Radio News.
We are your station for news.
News. This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. A vice president of the European Parliament, Eva Kaili, has been arrested by Belgian police in connection with an investigation into corruption that implicates World Cup host Qatar. The U.S. has taken into custody the person suspected of making the bomb that blew up Pan Am Flight 103 as it flew over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. British archaeologists are hailing the discovery of a necklace thought to be 1,300 years old.
Ho, ho, ho! It's Santa Claus here from the North Pole. I've had letters from thousands of Americans asking me for a new president for Christmas.
Then on January 6th, we're attacked and assaulted before our very eyes by 9.5 million turkeys. I tell you what, I was going to put him in a foot.
I've never felt such tension. It's like riding a psychotic horse towards a burning stable.
Merry Christmas to all! Merry Christmas!
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Dr. Andrew Huff is my guest this hour. We're talking about his book, The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. And Dr. Huff, you left Sandia Labs where you were working. You were doing highly classified work there, and you were getting tired of that. You wanted to move on to something else, and you came across EcoHealth Alliance. And at this point, Daszak's now in charge, and supposedly they're doing some kind of environmental work, and you were attracted to that. That was why you went there?
You nailed it. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Cool. And what did you think that they were doing?
I believe the mission. So the mission was that they were engaged in conservation work to prevent emerging infectious disease outbreaks, which has scientific validity to it. So the thinking mm-hmm. behind that is, if you can prevent people from being exposed to diseases out in remote parts of the world, in the jungle and caves, you can reduce infectious disease exposure and then transmission risk ultimately. The longer I worked at Eco Alliance, and then upon my promotion, I get to see under the hood of this PREDICT program. And I'm brought in as one of the people on the modeling and analytics team of the PREDICT program. And I was also a country coordinator. So there is a manual, or the historical scientific documents of this program was about 4 inches thick. And I actually took it upon myself to go read all these documents and start to understand what was going on. And then when I started being including all the different email communications, and the weekly meetings and, sub-team meetings and all these things, I realized that there was no way that they were going to accomplish the mission of PREDICT was to predict and forecast pandemics. They weren't collecting samples frequently enough. The sample sizes were too small scientifically or statistically to have power. That's some jargon there. They were not doing it in a uniform manner as how you'd want to do this to actually be accurate in your predictions. So I stepped back at one point. I said, I was thinking to myself, like, what the heck is really going on here? And at the time, it just seemed like one giant government contracting boondoggle. We're right. increasingly going after national security funds and Department of Defense funding. All the funding that I brought to the organization was from the Department of Defense. And I didn't really think that it was too... there was anything nefarious, especially about my funding at the time, because I'm like, well, I work in data and technology or quantitative epidemiology. These forecasting models are built by the government, and DOD pays for a lot of this stuff. And then they're shared across the enterprise of the government, so to speak. So I, especially with my work, I didn't think anything was off. And then I started to look at the bigger picture of what was going at Equal Health Alliance, and it just didn't make sense to me. And there were some other strange things that happened while I worked at Equal Health Alliance. So, for example, I was asked to submit a collaborator report to what's called the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency by my boss, Dr. Daszak. And IARPA is a sub-agency of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. I have no clue why I was asked to submit this report. It was specifically related to my work. Once I was promoted, I realized through sitting financial meetings, executive meetings, that we weren't receiving funding from these people. So that even made it stranger. Another aspect of this is that I was asked to help assemble a presentation for investment, so an investment pitch deck, which we presented to InQtel. The audience might not be familiar with InQtel, but InQtel is the venture capital firm for the Central Intelligence Agency, for the CIA and DOD. Their most famous investment, I think, is Google Maps or Google Earth. That was an investment from InQtel, which made that possible. They don't always disclose their investments, but in this proposal, we're actually presenting them with the going around the globe hunting for coronaviruses to do human to conduct humanized mouse gain of function work. And then at the end of the presentation or the pitch are my slides on my work. So we were actively seeking investment from the intelligence community for our work. Now, they don't always disclose their investments. I don't know whether or not they rejected our pitch or whether or not they decided to invest and didn't disclose it. But the interesting part here is that they invested into our partner company, Metabiota. And Metabiota has been all over the news because of Hunter Biden's investment into this company and then their tie to the Ukrainian biolabs, which was, and once you start to get into this mess, it is a soup of Beltway bandits and DC contractors that work in this laboratory biologic space that are all sort of frenemies, competing against each other, but then partnering on proposals to get the money to do this overseas work. And I helped co-write a number of these proposals. And after I left, I'm not sure which ones were awarded, but it was very typical DC Beltway bandit kind of behavior.
Well, let's go back to this. I'm getting a little bit of an echo here.
That happens. My communications get intercepted. I could reconnect real quick if it's bad.
I'm trying because I'm hearing me through my head. Am I coming over your? Are you using AirPods or a headset or of any kind?
No, because I may be coming at this point. But Michael, I have to tell you, this has happened a number of times. This is not the first time it's happened.
Well, actually, now it's gone away. So we'll just proceed on. So one of the things that I'm trying to understand is this idea that, you know, we're sending people out into the wilds, into these caves, into the bush to find these bats that are supposedly going to harbor these various exotic viruses. And then we're going to try to isolate those viruses and perhaps modify them to become more virulent. So we then in turn can sell the fear of this virus, I believe. I mean, I'm just trying to understand this business model because it almost seems to me like you're trying to find a solution to a problem that doesn't exist until we create that problem.
Well, you're absolutely right. If you were my student in an undergraduate class, I'd give you an A.
Thank you, brother.
That's exactly what's going on here. I mean, this is the argument of the camp that I've been in since I was a PhD student, why I've been against gain-of-function work, at least this type of gain-of-function work. So if you're going to go capture and isolate viruses, which are rare and not likely to be in contact with humans or livestock, okay, that's one thing. Then you take these viruses and then you enhance their infectivity, their transmissibility, their virulence, their pathogenicity. I mean, those are some big words, but if you're making these things worse, you're altering the function of these viruses. Well, why are you doing it? And then especially when they go to the splicing techniques where they're mixing inserts of infectious diseases, which wouldn't normally be in contact with each other in nature or from different species, it really doesn't start to make sense. And that's what happens with SARS-CoV-2. I think Dr. McCullough or Dr. Fleming, they made a pretty effective argument that this has been evolved 150 to 200,000 years in the future. And I went and reviewed their work and I agree with their assessment of that. Not all gain of function work is bad. So gain of function work has been around for a long time. It was first invented to make live attenuated vaccines. I'm not an anti-vaxxer by any stretch. I've had probably 39 different vaccines. And because I was in the military and I didn't always have my vaccine record with me, they hit me again with boosters for things I probably didn't need to be boosted for. So a lot of those vaccines are live attenuated vaccines and they've saved a lot of lives. They caused a lot of, prevented a lot of disability. But that's usually only going one step in forward in evolution. You could argue maybe two. But what they're doing now is completely insane. I mean, they're totally evolving these things in the future. And then they're making medical countermeasures for things that don't exist. And the whole crux of the mRNA jabs, this gene therapy, was that there's a real problem in public health and medicine and virology and vaccinology, that with traditional egg-based vaccines, you know, the system sort of works like this. New disease emerges, new strain of the flu, or maybe something we haven't seen in a real long time. Well, now we have the sample, and then we have to then isolate and then replicate that and then make a vaccine for it. It takes typically 9 months. And this has been a big fear of a lot of people in the medical industrial, the military medical industrial base, the national security folks, because if you're working in pandemic mitigation or pandemic prevention, bioterror, biowarfare, you will need something that you can modify rapidly to meet the conditions that you're experiencing either on the battlefield or your nation is experiencing. So this mRNA platform was developed as being the hope that they could rapidly sequence whatever was circulating and then create this and then put the drug right in production right away. So you could then have a vaccine in a matter of weeks or months, not almost a year. Well, we see how that played out. The technology quite isn't there yet. I don't know if it ever will be, but that's where this becomes an interesting story, because we could go into the whole aspect of how the emergency use authorization and the suppression of effective drugs and how it ties back into the origin of COVID, because SARS-CoV-2 and the agent, the agent and the mRNA countermeasure were co-developed in history. And there's some interesting things that happened with the patent filings related to various genetic components of the agent.
Let me ask you this. So I think you said that Moderna was patenting this in 2015. Dr. Peter McCullough was on here a few weeks ago, and he was working with a woman who, embarrassingly enough, I do not remember her name, but she has uncovered research that she claims shows that DARPA was working with Moderna on this in 2011.
Well, probably certain parts of it. So and here's the issue, and you should really get Dr. Robert Malone onto your show again if he hasn't been here, or McCullough, because they're better in this area than I am. And so I'm a quantitative epidemiologist, they're virologists, but there are three or four different paths of research, you could argue, which began in the late 90s. And it's a continual process. So they're trying to improve the technology. And Dr. David Martin has made these arguments. He's like, well, if you follow the patent trail all the way back, well, you get to a point where it's not SARS-CoV-2 specifically. So the references that I cite in the book, and then also the lawsuit that we filed with Tom Renz in the state of New York, is that they're really like 1 to 4 patents which can be directly tied to SARS-CoV-2. And those look like it's from the genetic material. And the other work that happened at Dr. Ralph Barrick's laboratory related to some of the sample collection that happens through the PREDICT program and the other samples which are being collected basically from this wide spectrum of programs funded by the U.S. government.
And you mentioned Barrick, so let's talk about him for a second, because one of the things you said, one of the biggest mistakes or intel failures of PREDICT was the introduction of Barrick to Bat Lady, whose name I'm forgetting for a second. And he turned over much of his information and kind of mentored her. Unfortunately, I think from what I'm reading from your work, she was not up to the task. And so are you inferring that research, which she was doing not as well as Barrick would have done, is part of the security problem that we had that allowed for the leak?
I think I can frame it a little differently. So the context here is that when I started breaking down this problem and trying to figure out what was going on myself, I asked to actually raise this question when I worked at Equal Health Alliance. Do the Chinese need $600,000 of American money to conduct gain of function work? I mean, think about it, $600,000, the Chinese lend us all the money in the world. They lend us all our money. They've got their own money. So what are the Chinese gained here? And everyone in the national security community suspected for a long time or knows that the Wuhan Institute of Virology is likely the bioweapons laboratory, the BSL-4 laboratory for the Chinese military, the Communist Party. So if you're in a Westerner and you want to be able to collect intelligence on that laboratory, how are you going to get people in there? So when I worked at the U.S. National Laboratory, we don't allow foreigners to just walk on the base. We don't allow anyone to come there. Well, first of all, at this particular facility I work, it's on a military installation. It's 100% security. And then there's layers of security the deeper you go into it, to classified space. So, you know, what's going on here? Okay, 600 grand, we're doing this. But what do the Chinese gain here? So they're going to let Westerners in. What are the Chinese getting at? Well, what's the Chinese history here? They lie, cheat, and steal from the United States. And if they wanted to gain anything here, it would be access to the people, the intellectual property, or to be able to exert their influence in this process some way. That's really what they have to gain. Plus, they're going to get $600,000 to pay out bribes. So I really think that that's what was going on here.
Dr. Huff, so basically we're spying on each other because I'll follow up on that on the other side. It sounds like we're giving them money and we're taking over these labs in various third world countries, essentially to keep them from working for someone else. I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Huff, and we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
The DailyMail.com recently reported some horrific news concerning the state of California. Thousands of convicted pedophiles in that trend-setting ultra-liberal state are being released from prison after serving only a few months for horrific acts, including rape, sodomy, and sexual abuse of kids under 14. More than 7,000 sex offenders were convicted of lewd or lascivious acts with a child, but were let out of prison the same year that they were incarcerated. This according to the California Megan's Law database. One man pleaded no contest to abuse of a child in 2015. He was sentenced to just 2 days in county jail and 5 years of probation. He now lives a block from a daycare center and 3 blocks from an elementary school, according to the Megan's Law database. And speaking of schools, don't think this isn't all related to the effort to confuse our kids sexually and do away with the term pedophile altogether and replace it with a more benign minor attracted people label with little consequences for offenders. This must be stopped and stopped now. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Hi, Australia. There's never been a better time to check up on your health. We have a world-class healthcare system that's easy to access, even when you can't be there in person. Telehealth enables you to catch up with your GP or health professional, and the Australian government has now made it permanently available through Medicare. Show your health some love, face-to-face, by phone, or video call. Care for your health. Find out more at australia.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
The FBI is orchestrating plots, riots, and massacres in an attempt to justify the nullification of your constitutional rights. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Dr. Andrew Huff is my guest this hour. For the remainder of this hour, his book, The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. It is definitely the book of the moment, and we are pleased to have him on the show. And Dr. Huff, what I was getting at is, if I'm understanding, because when you took this job, they assigned you, I believe you said, the Sudan and some other sub-African country. So you would go to these laboratories on behalf of EcoHealth Alliance. You would look at the laboratories. You would find them almost always completely inadequate for the research that they were supposed to be doing, but we would give them money essentially to keep their people employed so they wouldn't go rogue and work for someone else.
Well, I don't think that was necessarily the objectives of the PREDICT program. So the PREDICT program was very much focused on the sample collection. Yes, the only country that I traveled to on the PREDICT program was Jordan. Jordan's a fairly modern country, but I was still pretty shocked by the level of sophistication in biosafety in their laboratories. And I think Dr. Koresh, who was with me, was as well. I think we actually ended up using one of the royal laboratories, which was better in that country. But that was more the typical from talking to the other scientists at EcoHealth. You know, we'd show each other pictures of what was going on around the globe. Now, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, definitely more modern, but there are intelligence reports or reports from the State Department on cables and from U.S. government scientists and people working with the State Department, which validate my concerns about these laboratories, even this, the Wuhan or the WIV was, had subpar biosafety, had a subpar biosafety inspection or record, depending on how you want to look at it. But those are public documents, and I cite those in my book. What you're getting at, though, is a little bit different program. So the Defense Threat Reduction Agency has a what's called a Cooperative Biological Engagement Program. There's also a chemical version of that, too. And the idea is, or was, when the legislation was passed and the creation of these programs, that they wanted to partner up Western scientists, especially with the crumbling Soviet republics, so that they would be aligned with Westerners. We could evaluate their biosecurity, help them increase their biosecurity capacity in these places, which is sort of BS in my opinion, because it's difficult to measure. You know, are we telling these people to put locks on their freezers? I mean, it's sort of silly when you actually get down to what that means. But the best way you can actually do that is by building strong collaborative relationships with U.S. scientists and those scientists abroad. So they feel aligned to us. They can tell us what's going on. We can collect intelligence that way. And I think that's a good idea. As long as we're not giving them or trading them advanced biotechnology to do really harmful things, and then they're doing it unsupervised. But I don't think that's the case in most of these laboratories. There's been a lot of talk about the bio labs in Ukraine, how yes. they're doing all this dangerous work. I haven't seen it. So one of the investigative journalists from Bulgaria, she's an expert in this. She sends me all her documents and I review those. And it looks like traditional biosurveillance work. I don't really see anything nefarious happening. That doesn't mean that there wasn't nefarious or bad or harmful things or high risk things going on. I just haven't seen the proof yet. And, you know, we should be careful before we make bold accusations like that. And like I've done with my book.
Right. Okay. So let me just ask you this, because I think that what you're saying is that these bio labs, there's it probably in 30 different countries across the globe. And when we first started hearing about the fact that there were bio labs in the Ukraine, which I think was by accident, I don't know if Newland, I don't know if any of us in the outside of your industry knew about this until she brought it up in that, and Newland brought it up in that meeting to Rubio. But even then, I think people were like, God, that can't be right. Surely that's not right. And if what you're saying about Wuhan is that this escaped by accident because of inadequate security measures, but we've got these same kind of labs are partnered with them in 30 some odd countries. And then we're hearing that within Ukraine alone, there was a dozen to 30 some odd of these labs. Then there's a lot of these. And I guess it just seems to me like that's a lot of chances for things to go wrong.
I don't disagree with that, but I think there's even a more sinister way to look at this. This type of research is going on at major academic research institutions and universities all yeah. over the United States and all yeah. over the world. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that this work should not be happening in academic settings. I mean, so I used to have a BSL-2 laboratory at the university I worked at when I was a professor. And we had three professors in and out of sort of sharing that laboratory. We had multiple students in and out of there. Keys were handed off to people. And so other universities that I've been affiliated or worked with had higher BSL laboratories, three, and then the other one I can't talk about. But the security posture at a university is just lax inherently because it's an academic institution. So this gain of function work shouldn't be happening if it exists, should not be going down at universities. It should only be at national laboratories like I worked at. Where they have the clear security clearances, the strict training, the layered security approach, rigorous training around it. I mean, I have no problem with them doing this work at USAMRID or at MBAP in Kansas. I mean, if it's going to happen, you should be doing it in those kind of places. But it should not be happening at the University of North Carolina. It's just ridiculous. It shouldn't be happening at Columbia University in New York. The scientists, they have, you know, I call them these gene jockeys, have such this attitude that they have control of everything. And really they're relying on a bunch of undergraduate students, which are young adults, but don't have the experience or the expertise to understand the danger of the things that they're playing with a lot of times. And it just takes one person to mistake here. I mean, the issue here is not the engineering, it's the human in the loop. And I'm guessing if there's ever a full investigation of what happens in Wuhan, it's going to be, my guess is it's going to be some laboratory person makes a mistake in working in biosafety, biosecurity and biosafety standards, which are subpar. That's what most of the time laboratory accidents are. They don't happen. I mean, people get laboratory acquired infections. It happens in medical schools and veterinary schools. Sometimes it's almost a rite of passage in some laboratories that you get sick, especially if you're working with animals in the field. So, you know, it's a disaster waiting to happen in that type of environment.
Another thing that we've talked about on the show is that I have friends in the medical community who think that they got COVID in the U.S. towards the end of 2019. Now, we know that it went to Italy and some other countries, and I think that the outbreak in Italy was what discovered in late August or early September. And then you're saying that the cover-up with the Chinese and the U.S. government actually began in October. So I guess I'm putting this out there because it looks to me like that this thing spread much quicker than we even thought.
Oh, absolutely. So one of the tools, a highly predictive model that I built, had the flight passenger data for every person in the world. So a big data set, and then you could model, it's called you could do what's called a Monte Carlo assessment, which is like a random walk through a network. And you put this on basically a supercomputer in the cloud, and you can simulate, you know, where a disease can move. So when you look at it, flight structure and how interconnected the globe is, a disease can travel the globe in a week. You get one infected person who infects maybe two others, and then that two becomes four. You can see how the exponential growth here works. In fact, it looks like SARS-CoV-2 is more infectious or transmissible than this. So at every step, it's infecting more people. And think about it, you get sick, you go get on an airplane, you get a bunch of other people on the airplane sick, and then a day later, they're getting other people sick. And by the time they get to the next destination, they're all getting on different flights to go to different parts of the region or different parts of the world. And that's how quickly infectious diseases spread. Long gone are the days where, you know, when we're moving everything by ship around the planet, so there'd be these time lags or you could shut down a port. And this is why the big argument why lockdowns don't work is because with a global supply chain of people and goods moving long distances around the planet every day, a lockdown's rather ineffective. I mean, the only time that you could really use a lockdown is when they said 2 weeks to flatten the curve. There is truth to that. If you need to buy just 2 weeks to slow it down so you can assess the situation, get some more resilience in terms of hospital beds, doctors up to speed, maybe get a better assessment of the situation, that makes sense. But this prolonged lockdown nonsense just delays the inevitable. And what happened in the United States when the lockdowns were lifted? Boom, COVID took off.
Dr. Huff, we just got a minute or two left, so I want to ask you this one last question. And I'm not trying to make a gotcha question, but it's just something that I know a lot of people are going to think. It's like, if this was, in fact, an accidental leak, then what do we say to things like Event 201 that seem to have such eerily similar descriptive qualities to it? Because I know that you said that EcoHealth Alliance had many streams of revenue, some from the government, some from wealthy donors, some from various groups. And I don't know, I find it, do you have any thoughts on the similarities from the tabletop exercise as to what actually happened?
Yeah, so I've actually created and participated in tabletop exercises. And the thinking around them is this: it helps if you can train or condition the people to one of these scenarios of the event so they can manage it properly. They do these kind of exercises in the military all the time, especially like military tabletop exercises. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense. I find it really suspect with Event 201, given what I know now about how and when it was conducted, because maybe somebody else knew more and decided to do this one last training event to get everyone conditioned before this hit. And not that that's necessarily nefarious, though, right? So if you can still be a good actor and know that this was coming and say, well, geez, we should do one last tabletop exercise to get everyone ready before this is coming. But if that's the case, the real crime here is why the heck wouldn't they tell everyone right away? And that's what blows my mind. That's the failure of public health here, is that it does look like there was a coordinated effort to not get the truth out to the masses. And public health works best when we're openly communicating with the public what's going on. The CDC should have taken the lead. It shouldn't have been Dr. Fauci and all this nonsense that they created.
Amen, brother. Dr. Huff, thank you so much for coming on the show. I could talk to you for hours. I hope that you will come back because there's so much more I would like to ask you. Ladies and gentlemen, please buy the book. Go read it. The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. Thank you, Dr. Huff.
Thank you. Follow me on Twitter, AG Huff.
Right on, brother. All right. Cheers, you guys. All right. So we're going to take a break. We will be back on the other side. And Charlie Robinson is going to be with us in the second hour for Macro Aggressions. We've got a lot more. Stick around.